square, but it's quite another to build a series of such megaliths into a wall that looks like a Titan's Lego project. Still, let's accept that it can be done, that similar things have been done, and of course, for the evidence is before our eyes, that it was done at Baalbek. The only question that matters, therefore, is whether it was the Romans who did it, or whether they and the cultures that preceded them here going back 10,000 years or more found the U-shaped megalithic wall already in place and fitted their own structures into its embrace. That's what it looks like to me. The solid foundation rising above the plain at Baalbek that Daniel Lohmann identifies as pre-Roman and calls Podium 1, and on top of which the Temple of Jupiter was built, sits nicely inside the U-shaped wall, which embraces it on its south, west, and northern sides. At no point does the wall support the Temple of Jupiter. It is an entirely separate exterior structure. I walk several times along the western wall, gazing up in stupefaction at the awesome megaliths of the Trilithon, trying to get to grips with what they mean. Regardless of whether it was the Romans or some unknown antediluvian culture who put them here, what I'd like to know is why they put them 20 feet up. Why did they stack them on top of courses of smaller blocks, when surely the logic would have been to put the largest, heaviest blocks at ground level and add the smaller, lighter blocks above them? Why create the huge additional engineering and lifting challenge of doing it the other way round? I walk along the wall. I'm counting blocks and courses. First of all, working upwards from ground level, there are three courses of really quite small, let's say 1.5 meters high, quarter-ton ashlars. On top of these are six much bigger blocks, very nicely finished, although also very heavily eroded, with the upper half trimmed in to be narrower than the base. These six blocks, which are more or less identical to blocks in the south wall that I described in the previous chapter, weigh about 400 tons each. Finally, on top of them, come the three monster 800-ton blocks of the Trilithon. I walk north now, to the corner of the west and the north walls. The northernmost block of the Trilithon doesn't extend right to the end of the west wall. There's a gap, filled up by an Arab defensive tower extending from Podium 1 and built over the corner. But if I remove that tower in my mind's eye, then I can see what's going on, because on the other side of it is another huge row of megaliths forming the northern arm of the U-shaped wall, the row that I'd looked down on earlier from above. Indeed, the Arab defensive tower was the very one I stepped out on to get a proper view of this part of the megalithic wall, which is separated by a grassy gap 35 feet wide from the north wall of Podium 1. I know archaeologists see the U-shaped wall as the base of the Temple of Jupiter's grandiose but unfinished Podium 2. Lohmann makes a very good case for it being exactly that. But I'm still bothered by its non-load-bearing, purely cosmetic function if that's the case, and I can't shake the feeling that it was a feature the Romans inherited from a much earlier time. Where I do agree with the archaeologists, however, is that the even larger megaliths that I know are still in the quarry half a mile away, and that I'm going to take a look at as soon as I'm finished here, were definitely intended to sit on top of the northern and southern arms of the U-shaped wall, thus raising them to the height that the western wall attained with the placement of the Trilithon. True, they're a bit longer and wider than the Trilithon blocks, but after trimming off the boss left to protect them on their journey from the quarry, they would match exactly, fitting like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. This remains the case, whether the Romans made the U-shaped wall as part of Podium 2, or whether it was the work of the architects and masons of a lost civilization of prehistoric antiquity. And there's something else I agree with the archaeologists on. Ideas put into circulation decades ago by ancient astronaut enthusiasts, notably Zechariah Sitchin in his book Stairway to Heaven, first published in 1980, and in other later volumes of his Earth Chronicles series, cannot possibly be right. Whatever Baalbek is, and for whatever reason megaliths of 800 tons and more were used here, and whoever it was who put those megaliths in place, they definitely did not do so in order to create a landing place for the aircraft of the gods. Sitchin's claim that the raised platform of Baalbek was intended to support some extremely heavy weight, and that the heavyweight in question was a rocket-like flying chamber, could only have been made by a man who had no idea of the real appearance and layout of Baalbek itself, and could only be believed by others with no direct knowledge of the site. The giant megalithic blocks of the Trilithon that seemed to have convinced Sitchin the entire platform of Baalbek was megalithic all turn out to be parts of the U-shaped wall that embraces the only modestly sized Podium 1. And while an alien might conceivably land his spacecraft on even so modest a podium if there were no other structure there, he certainly would not want to land it on top of a wall. It follows, therefore, that to use the megalithic character of the U-shaped wall to claim that a podium, which it is not even connected to and does not support, was an alien landing platform designed to bear extremely heavy weights where all landings and takeoffs of the shuttlecraft had to be conducted, is either ignorant or disingenuous or both. Besides, even if the whole of the Baalbek complex was megalithic, which is not at all the case, we must ask ourselves why technologically advanced aliens, capable of crossing the solar system in their spaceships, would need such a platform to land on in the first place. If they could hop from planet to planet, as Sitchin asks us to believe, wouldn't their science be up to constructing something a little more high-tech and fit for purpose than that? In short, isn't it obvious that Sitchin simply took 1970s NASA space technology as his template and projected it onto his imagined ancient astronauts? I knew Zachariah Sitchin personally, had a few dinners with him in New York, and once drove him from Stonehenge to London when he was on a visit to England. I liked him well enough, and I think he did some good research, but on Baalbek at least I have no doubt now, after exploring the site myself, that his whole landing platform thesis is fundamentally flawed. This is not to say, however, that every idea set out in his books was equally compromised. The Mesopotamian cuneiform texts, which he could not read and translate as he claimed, his translations were adapted and to some extent fictionalized from the work of mainstream scholars, do in fact contain material of the greatest interest, and I think he was right to notice hints of high technology in them. But were those technologies alien or human? This is a question we'll return to in Chapter 16 when we'll consider what is known about certain powerful beings referred to in biblical and other ancient texts as the Nephilim and the Watchers. The biggest cut stone block in the world. I have found that archaeologists are seldom receptive to the notion of ancient astronauts, wrote Elif Batuman in an article about Baalbek in the New Yorker on the 18th of December 2014. Although one could argue that when the archaeologists went looking for answers, all they managed to find was an even bigger and more mysterious block. Indeed so. In June 2014, just a month before I arrived in Baalbek, the German Archaeological Institute made a stunning discovery in the quarries half a mile south of the Temple of Jupiter. There it had long been known lay two giant megaliths that are heavier by a significant margin than any of the stones in the Trilithon. What no one had suspected, however, despite a century of rather intensive investigations around Baalbek, was that a third immense block lay buried and hidden from view under the sediment that has accumulated in the quarry over the millennia. The archaeologists chose not to announce their discovery to the world until late November 2014, but since they had excavated it in June, it lay there in full view when I first visited the quarry on the 10th of July, and a local shopkeeper, who claimed that the discovery was in fact his and that the Germans had merely appropriated it, made a point of drawing it to my attention. The quarry is in two parts, divided by a road, and in the first area you come to as you approach from the direction of the temples lies the famous Stone of the Pregnant Woman, also known as the Stone of the South, which has been decorating postcards from Baalbek for 100 years and was known to travellers like David Urquhart long before that. It measures 21.50 metres, almost 71 feet in length, 4.20 metres, just under 14 feet in height, and 4.30 metres, just over 14 feet in width. It weighs 970 tonnes. Across the road, a second, even bigger megalith, which had lain undiscovered since time immemorial, was unearthed in the 1990s. It measures 20.5 metres in length, 4.56 metres wide, and 4.5 metres high. Its weight has been calculated to be 1,242 tonnes. But the megalith that was discovered in June 2014 has a mass greater than either of these, measuring 19.60 metres, 64 feet 4 inches long, 6 metres, 19 feet 9 inches wide, and 5.5 metres, 18 feet high, with an estimated weight of 1,650 tonnes. It was this newly excavated megalith, the single largest block of stone ever quarried in the ancient world, that the excited shopkeeper proudly pointed out to me during my visit. Its upper surface is less than 2 meters below the lower edge of the stone of the pregnant woman, which it lies immediately beside and parallel to. And like the stone of the pregnant woman, it is beautifully cut and shaped, ready, after removal of the boss, to go straight into the U-shaped wall for which all three giant blocks were undoubtedly intended. I spend some hours clambering around these weird, otherworldly blocks. I feel as though I'm mountaineering. The scale is so immense, and in a way so alien, that a curious detachment from everyday reality sets in, and I lose all track of time. I note that the stone of the pregnant woman appears to have been sliced through at the base, where it emerges from the bedrock, with a clean, straight cut. How was that done? And no matter where I stand, above, below, beside, I am dwarfed by this monstrous product of ancient and unknowable minds. The very thought that someone, in some distant epoch, could conceive of this, could cut it out and shape it entire, and then at the end just leave it here, abandon it, forget about it, is incomprehensible to me. The closer I examine it, the more details I observe of the precision of the workmanship, of the scale of the enterprise, and of the will and imagination that went into its creation, the more certain I become that it and its fellows here in the quarries, and the Trilithon, and the other giant megaliths of Baalbek were not the work of the Romans. I know how profoundly Daniel Lohmann disagrees. A few months later, in February 2015, he and I will correspond at some length over several days. He will graciously answer many questions and help me to understand some of the complexities of Baalbek that escaped me when I was there. He'll make an excellent case for the Roman provenance of the whole vast scheme. He will even send me a photograph of the column drum built into the foundations of the Trilithon wall, and he'll write, "In my recent work, I located this column drum fragment, excavated it anew, and measured it millimeter precise to determine the drum diameter. I looked at the surface structure and mason's dressing in comparison with the Jupiter temple columns and the lithology. All indications are exactly the same as the column drums of the Roman Jupiter temple. The fragment was neatly dressed at the edges to make a masonry ashlar out of it, and it received the beautifully sharply cut edges that all ashlars of the Roman Jupiter temple phase have, including the megaliths." My reply. First of all, to be absolutely clear, I don't dispute that this fragment is from a column drum of the Roman Jupiter temple. Clearly it is. And I don't dispute the generally agreed dating of the columns of the Roman Jupiter temple. But this fragment is a very important part of the formidable edifice of logic you and your colleagues used to establish the chronology of the Trilithon, and that many others have relied upon when reporting that chronology. What I'd like to interrogate a little further, therefore, is your level of certainty that this column drum fragment was put there at the same time as the original construction of the Western Wall. It's nicely cut and shaped, I agree, but still it sticks out like a sore thumb, especially now I see it cleared in the photo you kindly sent me. It looks intrusive, odd, and awkward, very different from the rest of the blocks in this course. In short, I think the argument can be made that it is more likely to be a later repair of the wall than it is to be an integral part of the original wall. Lending some support to this argument is that we know the Arabs were constantly repairing the walls around the whole site, and sometimes using column drums to do so. So why shouldn't this be just one more of those repairs? What is the absolutely compelling archaeological evidence that completely, effectively, and once and for all rules this possibility out? I'd be most grateful if you could address that specific point in your reply. Lohmann comes right back to me on this. The fragment is just one of the indications that shows the synchronicity of the megalith podium and the temple, which was not our result, but known to science for over 100 years, and at latest since the excavations by the German team of 1900 to 1904. Yes, it sticks out, but no, not unlike the others, the builders of the temple were rather pragmatic. Once the structure was to be hidden underneath the soil or behind something else, they didn't bother to flatten the surfaces or make it look nice. What was important first when building is that the ashlar was perfectly flattened on the top and bottom, and then the two sides, in order to create a solid and stable wall. And that was done on the column drum, exactly in the same Roman manner as it was done on the blocks around it. If you look at the length of the fragment and imagine a hole in the wall instead, the two smaller ashlars in the course above would fall, causing further instability for the structures above. Here, frictional connection, force closure, translations of Kraftschluss from my dictionary, language barriers, is needed. You can't just replace an ashlar in a row of stretchers. Secondly, Arab repairs of Roman walls look a lot different. They used smaller blocks instead and would never have been able to squeeze a block in so tightly. Medieval repairs never have such tight joints. It's a comparison of precision that makes an engineer like me 100% certain. After examining our own photographs of the Trilithon wall, Santa took a great many while we were there, I find myself unpersuaded by Lohmann's argument. First of all, this column drum is not hidden underneath soil or behind something else. It's in plain view, in the lowest visible course of the wall, and it does stick out like a sore thumb. It's made of a distinctively different, much darker stone, and it has a very different look from any neighboring block. It is quite unique, in fact. Secondly, as to precision, I don't agree with Lohmann that the column drum cannot be an Arab repair. In plates 42 and 43, the reader will find an example of another column drum, which is certainly part of an Arab repair to the walls of Baalbek, and its precision is as good as that on the column drum in the foundations. Another possibility I've considered, that it could be a Roman repair to a pre-Roman wall, also remains very much in play. If the lower block, which this improvised block replaced, had been badly damaged, and a decision had been made to remove it, the two small rectangular blocks above it, the ones Lohmann said would fall, causing further instability for the structures above, would have had to be removed at the same time. But the next course up is so set that none of the other blocks in it would have fallen, nor would any instability have been caused to the huge megalith in the course above that, which is supported on no less than five large horizontal blocks, three of which would be entirely unaffected by the removal of the two smaller blocks below, while the other two would have been held in place by frictional connection. Once the column drum had been cut to shape and put in place at ground level, the two smaller blocks could have been slid back into the wall above it, completing a very neat and effective repair. There's something else, a fundamental area of disagreement, concerning what I see as a U-shaped megalithic wall surrounding Podium 1, but that Lohmann sees as the first courses of Podium 2. He tells me that aside from the size of the ashlars, what I call a U-shaped megalithic wall is the bottom of a standard shape of a Roman temple podium after Augustus times. He asks me to take a look at the podium of the Maison Carrée in Nîmes and suggests that the temple of Bacchus in Baalbek itself also has a similar podium. He sends me links to photographs. If you zoom in, he writes, you can see the stones of the second layer above the bottom layer, corresponding to the Trilithon. My reply. You write that the megalithic